This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. What started as Mommy and Me swimming classes turned into a lifelong passion for Skylar Baylar. He was swimming solo at the age of one, and by 13 was competing on a national level, and Ivy League swim teams were aggressively pursuing him. What people did not know was about the battle going on inside. After taking a gap year, Skylar came out as trans. And that has been his mission, to share that story every year since. Skylar is in North Carolina, part of the Give Back Tour. He's going to be at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro next Monday, but joins us now. Skylar Baylar, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, Frank. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start with your swimming story first. Take us back to your earliest memories of swimming.
Oh, goodness. I've told that I started in the bathtub, but the first real swim meet that I can remember, I was probably six or seven. Probably looked like I was drowning, but I had a great time. I've always loved being underwater and just feeling weightless.
When did you? I mean, there's one thing to say you love it, and then there's a moment when you really want to compete. When did you feel that need to compete?
Honestly, that took far longer. The beginning of my swim career, I actually was very adamant that I did it only because I loved it. And when asked to be good, I said, no, I don't want to push myself to be good. I just want to do it because I love it. And I was afraid of losing that enjoyment. But around the age of 12 or 13, I had actually gotten surgery on both my feet for a genetic defect, and I was not allowed to do impact sports. And so I started swimming more. And my coach said, hey, you could be really good, and you need to focus. And in that moment, this is around the age of 12, I decided, okay, let's give it a go. Let's see what happens if I actually double down and try to be competitive.
Well, what happened was you broke a lot of records when you started competing. Talk about some of the records you've broken. Don't be shy. I've asked you.
Okay. That's probably my least favorite. I don't know. The records that I began breaking were mostly from my summer league pool, which is a much lower key atmosphere, and those are shorter races. And I think that was the first place I started to feel like I could be good. Mm. Beyond that, I broke team records on my first swim team, and then my high school team. At the time, I held all of the records that I could when I was there. Mm. And then when I was 17, my relay team broke a national age group record. So we were the fastest 15 to 18 year old medley relay at the time. And that was my sort of like biggest, I think, accomplishment in that sense.
From an area of the country up around McLean, Virginia, Northern Virginia, that is renowned for the number of high quality competitive swimmers that come out of that region, right? So that's a competitive place that you're living in and competing in.
Yeah, absolutely. And the relay that I just spoke of, the anchor, the freestyler on that relay was Katie Ledecky. So we definitely had quite a few well-known and very fast swimmers on that team.
You have come to the attention, or by then had come to the attention, of a number of schools and were recruited by Harvard, right?
Yes, yeah. So in September, I was recruited by them. Yeah.
Well, tell me about that. I mean, what that was like to have their coaches come to you and their staff come to you and say, we need you on our team.
It was very, very humbling. I was very excited by that. I knew in high school that academics were really important to me as well, so I didn't want to go to a school where academics would get lost. So that was why I was focusing on the Ivy League, specifically Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and Princeton, because they also had very good swim programs. I was super, super excited, very enthused by the prospect of it, and just hopeful that it would all work out.
And you were recruited for the women's team. You were living your life as a girl and a young woman at that moment, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct.
So it's also in this moment, and take us and give me the timeline now, because you're recruited, it's an exciting moment for you, but you're also, or when did you begin to know that you were someone who needed to be in transition?
So I was recruited in September of 2013. That's the fall of my senior year. And that whole year, I was really, really struggling with my mental health. So despite getting recruited to Harvard, I wasn't happy at all. And I always kind of explained that time was very confusing to me. I was very lost. I was miserable. And I kind of held on by my teeth to my swim career. And by the end of that year, I actually ended up deciding to take a gap year. I had no idea about my identity at the time. I just knew that I was really, really spiraling downwards with mental health. So I took a gap year. I went to a mental health treatment center actually for an eating disorder, which was what I was struggling with the most. And I spent 131 days at this center. And it was there that I was really able to find the space to describe my identity and to really introspect about my identity. And that's where I finally said to myself and to others that I'm transgender.
Tell me how that came about. What was happening that allowed you to identify this gender conflict as the source of your difficulties?
Sure. So the first thing is, I think that there were sort of seeds to that my whole life, you know, but I was so focused on swimming and school and sort of finding, you know, theoretical excellence in both, that I didn't ever take the time to think about myself. And I, you know, that's a thing that I think is a fault of many school systems, that they don't teach you to invest in emotions, invest in learning about your emotions, and invest in learning about your own identity as much as they do about, you know, academic achievements. So that's the first factor. The second thing is, I was doing a lot of therapy. I had a fantastic therapist who pushed me to talk about things that were hard for me, which is, you know, sort of where the game is. And I, you know, I actually ended up meeting another trans person in treatment as well. And that changed my life. You know, that was the first time in my entire life I was able to see myself in someone else and see my identity mirrored in somebody else. And I spent that whole day crying because it was so overwhelming to me emotionally. But like I said, it absolutely changed my life. And it showed me that there was more of a possibility for me to be myself.
And this is all because you took this gap year, and you said something very interesting early on, that all of this drive for excellence is in some ways sort of anesthetizing you to the real core needs that you had, right? You're not paying attention to these because you're succeeding over here, so why bother? And I've got this thing and maybe this nagging sort of sensation somewhere else, but as long as I succeed. And I want you to maybe take a snapshot of that moment, if it is a snapshot. When you say, no, wait, this isn't working, this drug that I'm taking is not answering the problem that I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really great question. So I think that the first moment, there's many sort of tiers of moments in that discovery. But I think the first moment was when my therapist said to me, hey, I don't actually think this is in high school before I took my gap year. I don't actually think I can help you. I think you really need to get more help. And it kind of struck me in that moment that my mental health was going to start impacting everything. And that if I was, you know, if I had all these goals of my life and none of them involved being miserable, all of them involved understanding myself and feeling at peace with myself and feeling happy. And sure, they involved other goals that included, you know, quote unquote excellence, as we've been, you know, speaking of, but none of them involved being miserable. And I realized in that moment that if I wanted to achieve any of my goals, including the sort of intangible goals such as happiness and peace, that I was going to have to focus on myself and my mental health and my, you know, introspective values, if that makes sense.
So it does make sense. And then you do that and take the gap year. You are helped enormously, as you suggest, by some really good therapy and you coming to this moment where you're in tears and you're meeting someone who is trans and recognizing that this is where you need to go. What happens next for you? Because now you sort of have to make the announcement to yourself, but then the rest of your loved ones. What happens next?
So the biggest thing that happened in that moment was actually a lot of fear, because there was an initial sort of wave of relief because this, you know, this realization explained a lot about my childhood. It explained a lot about my own misery. And I think sometimes having words to explain one's struggle can be vastly peace-giving. But I, you know, as we've stated multiple times, I had been recruited to swim for the Harvard women's swim team, and sports, you know, gender is incredibly important in sports and all that kind of stuff. And there's really not a way to hide gender, especially in swimming when you're basically naked. And so I immediately was terrified, and I was so worried that I was going to lose swimming. I was going to lose my team. I might lose Harvard. And in that sort of flurry, I made a commitment to myself. This is, you know, taking weeks of time of crawling over all this information to myself. But I made a commitment to be honest with my coach. And my coach knew that I'd taken this gap year, right? She knew that I was struggling mental health-wise, but she knew nothing about the gender. And she called me sort of consistently asking how treatment was going. And so one time when she called, I told her. And I said very flatly, I think that I'm transgender. I don't know, you know, what this implies about sport and all that kind of stuff. I do know, though, that I want to swim. And to her, you know, absolute credit and great personhood, she said, listen, you know, we recruited you, we love you, and I don't know what this means either, but I do know that if you want to swim, you have a spot on this team, and we're going to figure it out. So I had really good support in that sense, and that gave me the space to start thinking about what would be best for me.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, and I know in your story that first of all, she gives you that space, like, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, instead of pressuring you into making some quick decision. But then you at some point thought, well, all right, how about if I swim as a woman and then I make this transition, but I stay kind of right where I am?
She
coached you out of that, too.
Well, she didn't coach me out of it, and I think it's really important that to note that neither of the coaches at Harvard ever pushed me to do anything but investigate options. I don't think she ever pushed me to be off the women's team. I mean, that was far against her interest, at least as an athletic coach, right? Because I would have, you know, potentially helped the success of that team. But she was always saying, let's find what's going to make you happy, because happy swimmers are fast swimmers. And I, as a mom, cannot push you to do anything that's going to make you unhappy. So I want you to think about options, which is why she ended up talking to the men's coach, who then gave me the opportunity to swim for the men's team and allowed me to choose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's my point. I think it's fascinating that a coach that really could have exploited your talent as a top women's swimmer, and you were at the top of your game, she could have said, well, that's a good decision. Why don't you stick with me for 4 years and then work it out later? And rather than do that, said, look, what's best for you in all of this? Let me go talk to the men's coach and give up a great prospect. So I found that, you know, a pretty inspirational story. And then talk about what happened on the men's side.
Sure. So the men's side, Coach Kevin Terrell at Harvard offered me the spot, and he actually ended up talking to his whole team and asked them, so before they brought this prospect to me, he said, so we have this trans swimmer. Do we want to be the kind of team that brings this kid on? And everybody said yes. And he said, if anybody has an issue, please come talk to me, you know, in my office, and you know, you're totally welcome to have concerns. And nobody did. And I know my team, they're very vocal, and they would have said something. So that was the first step of the team saying, sure, let's try it. And this isn't to say that everybody was super educated on trans, you know, issues. They definitely were not, but they were open to the idea of welcoming some difference. And that's definitely a consistent attitude on my team. So they brought that to me. It took me a while to accept the position, because I was so terrified, because this was something new, because somebody hadn't done it before. And I, you know, began my journey on the men's team. And it has been excruciating. It has been hard, but it has also been wonderful. It has also been the best decision I think I ever made in my life for myself. It's been eye-opening, and it's been an avenue for me to be able to prove also to the world that this is possible, it is possible.
Go ahead. Sorry. Finish.
That it's possible for a D1 men's team to include a transgender athlete on their team openly and well.
And one that did pretty well, but I want to ask you about that, because, as I say, you were one of the top swimmers in the country on the women's side. Now you're going to be competing with men. Did that worry you? Like, how am I going to, like, I might even make the team.
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely terrifying to me. That was one of the main reasons, actually, that I hesitated to make that decision, because I was so afraid of giving up all of the potential success I could have on the women's side. I mean, I had worked my entire life, right, to be that winning swimmer. And this would surely be giving up being a winning female swimmer, absolutely, and giving up a lot of potential. And I ended up making that decision because I knew that I needed to be happy, and I needed to make sure that I prioritized myself and my mental health and all that kind of, you know, theoretical excellence. I call them paper successes, you know, things you can write down on a piece of paper weren't going to mean anything to me if I wasn't happy.
You were. Tell us, though, how you did, because it was not exactly at the top, although you compete well and you're in the top third in a lot of categories.
Yeah.
But so what's that like, though? But from going from the top, the guy, you know, the athlete who is expected to win, to one who's going to do pretty well.
Sure. It's absolutely humbling, and I think there was the first year there was a lot of work that I did with myself, sort of sports psychology work, to make sure that I was competing against myself and that I was trying very hard not to compare myself to everybody, which is kind of like a complicated thing to do in sport, very ironic in some senses.
Right.
But a lot of it is working. I mean, at the end of the day, that is what everybody is doing. They're trying to beat their last time, right? They're trying to go best times, and if you keep doing best times, you're going to eventually beat other people. And so a lot of it was focusing on that and making really, really, really realistic goals for myself. So it wasn't like I got in the pool and was like, hey, I'm going to, you know, let me try to get first place, which is what I used to do. It was, okay, like, let me see if I can go faster than yesterday. Let me see if I can beat the slowest person on the team. Let me see if I can go this time. And really paying attention to that. And the team is really good at that, because there are a lot of people who have varying speeds on the team, despite the fact that we were actually eighth in the nation this year. Everybody has a position on the team that's important, and we're all focusing on other people making their goals.
There are a lot of questions about testosterone and hormones as it relates to trans athletes. What are the rules with regard to swimming, and in your case?
So the NCAA actually has a policy that was built in 2010 about this. And for my case, if you are a trans man, which is how I identify, assigned female at birth, identify as male, if you don't take testosterone, you can compete on either team. And that is because there's no biological advantage over women and there's no biological advantage over men. You have a lower testosterone level. If you want to compete as male, then you can take testosterone, but you have to have a medical exemption form that basically says that you're taking testosterone for gender dysphoria, and you have it regulated. So I submitted labs all 4 years. I competed all four seasons in the beginning and the middle of the season to basically prove that my testosterone levels were at an average male level.
There are a lot of changes surrounding trans athletes at every level. And I know North Carolina now allows trans athletes to compete as the gender they identify with, and that represents a change. Tell me about the impact that this is going to have on college athletics when states like North Carolina do this.
I think that the biggest thing that we're looking for is to allow students to have, and kids, really younger kids, to have the opportunity to compete in sport, because sport can be life-changing. I'm not sure about exactly what kind of impact it's going to have on the NCAA, because the NCAA has had this policy in for almost a decade at this point. And so perhaps, you know, the changes are going to be in colleges that haven't previously had to implement the policy. And it's sort of about the inclusion of high school athletes, because there are more and more trans kids able to compete in college and in high school. But I think we're going to see more inclusion, hopefully, and more diversity, which only ever makes anything better, in my opinion.
Now, tell me about the nature of your tour and kind of why you're doing what you're doing now, making your story public.
Sure. So the main thing that drives me to share my story in any audience, in any space, is the reason when I was a kid and when I was looking for people as I was coming out, I was looking for trans athletes. I was looking for queer swimmers. I was looking for trans swimmers, and I found nothing. I Googled over and over. I remember the summer I came out, I Googled every single night looking for somebody that could tell me that this was possible, that I was possible, that my identity was possible, and I found nobody. And so when I decided to be open about this, the reason was so that kids could Google and find somebody when they Googled trans swimmer, when they Googled LGBTQ swimmer. And now when you do, I come up. And it's not about me coming up. It's about a trans athlete coming up and proving that possibility. The tour is an extension of that. It's a desire to increase awareness, raise visibility of trans folks, of trans athletes, of trans people of color, of LGBTQ folks of color, because I fit most, you know, all of those intersectionalities. And we originally designed the tour to hit sort of under-resourced places, places that wouldn't necessarily have as much LGBTQ or trans-specific exposure. We sort of hit that goal, 50% to 60%, but I'm really pleased with that, and I'm really excited to be sharing my story.
Well, what are you going to be doing next? You've left college now, and you are doing this tour. What happens next?
So this tour ends in about 5 weeks, and I have just moved to Seattle before I began this tour, and I have a job teaching emotional intelligence skills to the employees at a financial services company. I'm very passionate about social emotional learning, which is actually a focus of my talks on this tour as well. And so that's what I'll be doing when I return.
Skylar Baylor is the first NCAA Division I transgender men's athlete. He is on the Give Back Tour. He will be at UNCG on Monday, September 16th at 7 o'clock. We've got the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Skylar, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
You as well. Thank you so much.